Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to today's episode of Resounding Echoes. Echoes. Now, last week, in the context of Arnold Schönberg's first chamber symphony, I spoke about the extensive use of the interval of a fourth as a means of drifting away from traditional harmonic thinking and opening up new possibilities of extending or even escaping tonality. So before I go any further today, I want to focus a little on this idea of intervals and exactly what I mean when I talk about fourths or thirds, because I don't want to presume any musical knowledge on the part of anybody who may be listening to this program. So when I do mention any strictly musical terms, I want to try to be as clear as possible. So on that note, I want you to think of a sound as a spectrum, like light. I mean, sound travels in waves as light travels in waves. Light, visible light, is a form of radiation. You know, if you think that, what we can see is the spectrum of radiation between red and violet. You know, the radiation that we perceive as visible light does not finish where it finishes for us. I mean, there is radiation beyond red, which is called infrared, but we don't have the apparatus that's able to process infrared as visible light. And the same way, at the other end of the spectrum, you have ultraviolet. And the same thing again, it exists, but it's not something we are able to process with our eyes. There are many species on the planet who are able to process much higher and lower frequencies of light than us, but we are limited in that sense. So light has a spectrum in that sense, as does sound. You know, there are some sounds are too low for us to hear, and some sounds have a pitch that's so high we cannot perceive them, because basically our ears are limited. But sound waves continue beyond the spectrum that's open for us. And so we have this spectrum of sound, and all musical cultures divide up this spectrum into different parts. Now, usually equal parts, although that's not necessarily, but we divide it in different ways. I mean, what's the typical way it's divided in the West and in the Western classical tradition is not something that's a physical part of nature or a law of the universe. The way we divide up the spectrum of sound is very arbitrary and very artificial. It's just basically an agreement. It's something we've agreed on, quite a few centuries now. And what I mean is, basically, you know, when we talk about a musical scale, you know, a scale is divided up into a certain number of equal parts. Now, I'm going to have to provide a few musical examples here. Now, normally, our resident Resounding Echoes Orchestra would provide these examples, but unfortunately, they are currently on strike. Or to be more precise, our flautist is on strike because he's demanding that if we want him to double on piccolo, we should by rights pay him a double salary. Now, he may have a point, but unfortunately, we spent our entire budget on our imaginary concerts, so we just don't have the money to pay his double salary. So the rest of the orchestra, in solidarity, have downed mouthpieces, mallets, and maracas. So the musical examples will have to be provided by yours truly with my own six-string wooden orchestra. Now, what I'm talking about is all notes have a frequency, you know, and because of the sound waves, as I explained before in a previous episode of this series. And when you play a note and the same note, the exact same note, like a C or a Do, if you will, when you play that same note at a higher frequency or a lower frequency, basically what happens is there's a mathematical relationship between that. That's part of nature. So for example, if I play a C and then the same note, the second note there is an octave above the first note. They are the same note. Just one has exactly double the frequency of the other. That's why they sound the same, and that's why one sounds lower than the other. Now, when I'm talking about dividing up, that octave, the distance between those two notes. Now, how you divide up the distance between those two notes is completely arbitrary. In the West, as I said, for a number of centuries, we typically have divided this gap into 12 equal parts. And each part is called a semitone. And a semitone is seen as the limit of the difference between two notes in the Western tradition. Now, there is nothing, as I said, there is nothing definitive about this semitone. It's just an artificial agreement. You can divide an octave into smaller parts, into bigger parts. You can divide an octave, like, so we divide an octave into 12 parts, but you can divide an octave into 24 parts, into 30 parts, into 85 parts, if you wish. We, as I said, we have this agreement where we divide an octave, the distance between this and this, into 12 equal parts. And the distance between each individual part is called an interval. For example, the distance between a note on the piano and the one right next beside it, this one, for example, that's a semitone. That's the smallest distance between notes in the typical Western tradition. And every interval, so the distance, this distance, every interval has a name. You can think of it like a character or a personality. So for example, that one, the smallest one, is called a minor second. And if you go up, the next one, that's a bigger distance. That's two semitones, or two semitones makes one tone, logically. That's called a major second. And so the intervals go up like this. The bigger the distance, they have a different name. So then you have, for example, the next one, three semitones is a minor third. Four semitones, which is a very harmonious, very classical interval, is a major third. And you keep going. And last week, I spoke a lot about fourths, which is this sound. And it goes on. You know, there's from fourths to fifths to sixths to sevenths until you come to the octave. And the octave has its name because it's eight parts. It's eight steps from that note to the other note. Okay, it's eight steps. I mean, we do divide it into 12 parts, but that's another part. It's another story, because when you divide up an octave, traditionally, it's like if you think of the white and black notes on a piano. In the scale of C, you can play all 12 notes from one C to the next. You can go, and that's the 12 parts of what's called the chromatic scale. That's all the white and black notes from one note to its repetition at a higher pitch. But typically, for example, when you play the C, you don't include the black notes. For example, the typical scale of C, the Do, Re, Mi, is. So that's the scale of C, that's without the black notes. That's called a diatonic scale, which is far more important than the chromatic scale in traditional music. Okay, so I'll leave that there, and I hope that's clear, or a little bit clearer as regards what am I talking about when I talk about intervals. Now, so let's get back to what we have on today's menu. Now, one of the most famous, indeed infamous, intervals is known as the augmented fourth, or it has another name, it has various names, but the other most common one is called a tritone, because tritones are six semitones. It's right in the middle. Or another traditional name for this interval is the devil in music. Now, why? Because this interval for centuries has been famed and feared as the most dissonant of all intervals. Now, for all these reasons, it is not surprising that its use became very appealing to many composers at the beginning of the last century, not to mention heavy metal bands from the 1970s onwards. Now, chromaticism, I just mentioned the chromatic scale, basically is the inclusion of more and more notes in a piece not strictly belonging to typical scales and keys. So for example, yes, when you play in the key of C on the piano, you typically, traditionally, you don't play any black notes, only white notes. But if you include the black notes, if you include one black note or two black notes, the more black notes you include, the more chromatic the scale becomes. So this idea of increased chromaticism was an ever more present feature of music in the late 19th century. So increased dissonance was a logical next step in this direction, as was the inevitable conclusion of the complete emancipation of all dissonance and the ultimate democratization of music without any note dominating or having more importance than any other of its comrades in a scale, melody, or theme. Now, my first piece today is a wonderfully evocative affair that makes great use of the tritone. Listen for it in the bass here, like the tolling of a church bell. Now, we have just heard part of a piece called Minuit Passé, which is the first of four pieces of a cycle with the title Clair de Lune in the plural, written by French composer Abel Descaux between the years 1900 and 1907, but not published until 1913. That particular piece is dated December 1900, which strictly speaking means it shouldn't be included in this series, but I'll make an exception. But that date only makes it all the more impressive for its precocity. Descaux peppers many of his chords throughout this cycle with tritones and other wrong notes in his bid to create an atmosphere evoked by moods, visions, and images typical of the world of Edgar Allan Poe, whose works had such a powerful influence on an entire generation of French artists, not only French, but especially in France, and Decaux himself was French. So it's relevant to what we're talking about today. Now, the third of the set, and the last to be composed, is La Cimetière, the graveyard. There you have it, the sounds of modal jazz half a century before Bill Evans, at least to my ears anyway. I have already alluded to the date of these compositions. It seems that establishing precedence is of the utmost importance for some. Who was the first composer to do this or that seems almost a matter of life or death. I think this is missing the point and somewhat childish, to be sincere. These partisan efforts to establish precedence are in a similar vein to the tiresome way some people try to establish who was the best rock guitarist or drummer, as if music were an Olympic discipline. What matters more is that precedence makes no sense without understanding the relationship any seemingly revolutionary art has with tradition, whether that be one of love or hate, and that at a given time, for various reasons, certain fruits are ripe for plucking, and who plucks them is less important than the fact that sooner rather than later they will be plucked, and maybe simultaneously by various individuals. The history of science and technology, no less than art, is full of examples of this kind of serendipity. Newton and Leibniz and their invention, or discovery, that's another can of worms, of calculus, or Russell Wallace and Darwin and the idea of natural selection are two that quickly come to mind. The musical orchard was ripe for atonality at the end of the 19th century, and the pluckers were bound to come. What makes the difference between one plucker and another is what they did with these fruits. Some took one bite and tossed the fruit over their shoulder. Others squeezed every drop of juice and pulp out of them to make the stickiest, messiest, and most succulently fresh jam dripping with the most exotic, delicate, and delicious flavors. I mean absolutely no disrespect, but strictly and solely in the context of my fruity analogy, Abel Decaux was a tosser, in that this set of four piano pieces was the only original work he ever published. He left the arduous work of harvesting and processing these forbidden fruits to others. Speaking of which, after all our moonlight adventures, let's get back to Earth. That was an excerpt from another rarely heard jewel from the musical catalogue of Arnold Schoenberg. It is called Frieda auf Erden, P Peace on Earth. Years later, Schoenberg referred to this piece as an innocent illusion of his youth. As someone who lived through the senseless carnage of the First World War, you can imagine that the idea of peace and harmony among the peoples of the earth seemed at best like a fanciful, blinkered dream. Maybe in some parallel fashion, this has something, or rather an awful lot, to do with why traditional harmony, which is stretched all over the place in Frieda auf Erden, was no longer feasible for Schoenberg going forward. Similarly to how and why traditional figurative art was no longer viable for Picasso or Kandinsky, or a first-person omnipotent author just didn't meet the needs of how James Joyce experienced reality. Nothing happens in a vacuum, and no woman nor man is an island. I hold these pieces to be among the most interesting and original of our times. What the composer has to say is out of the ordinary and entirely individual. So wrote Ferruccio Busoni on hearing Bartók's 14 Bagatelles, of which you have just heard a snippet of the opening piece. Most people would probably consider Duke Bluebeard's Castle from 1911 as Bartók's first masterpiece. But in the 2 or 3 years leading up to that extraordinary work, he composed a wealth of fascinating piano music, of which this set of Bagatelles is arguably the greatest. Right here and now, I can't think of anything of similar dimensions that is so extraordinarily rich in invention and pregnant with possibilities. What is more incredible is that it is all done in such a playful, seemingly throwaway manner, and not at all portentous. They were composed in the spring of 1908. Their brazen novelty is there right from the first piece, which is one of the earliest examples of clear polytonality, or bitonality to be more precise, with the right hand playing in one key and the left hand in another. Or is it? It seems more likely that Bartók was in fact, by making this bitonality so starkly obvious on the printed page, was ridiculing or at least playing with those pointless and erroneous attempts to pigeonhole music. And I think also wishing to emphasize that a lot of seemingly new sounds to Western classically trained ears had been an inveterate part of various European traditional musical cultures for years uncountable, as the piece, despite what the score says, is not in two simultaneous keys. Does such a thing make any real sense? But closer to a piece in the old Phrygian mode, and basically in C major. Like Schoenberg, he exploits forts in ingenious ways in several of these pieces, but it is almost certain he had no knowledge of Schoenberg's First Chamber Symphony at this time. In that fourth bagatelle of the cycle, we can hear folk music, here specifically a song called When I Was a Young Cowherd, and its different scales and modes starting to play a role in Bartók's so-called modernism, a resource which Bartók would go on to exploit like no other. Some sounds may be very old, but can sound incredibly new if they have been ignored or forgotten long enough. I already alluded to the playful aspect of these pieces, but this is not true of all of them. The penultimate is a lento funèbre, with the title She is Dead. Its composition is dated February 14th, and Bartók here is making very clear reference to the demise of his doomed romance with the famous violinist Steffi Gerr. It includes a four-note motif which you can find in many of his subsequent works, not dissimilar to the Shostakovich motif I played back in an earlier program in this series. If all this were not enough, the cycle as a whole is full to bursting with Bartók's pulsating rhythmic vitality, which even at this early date is utterly unique, as Bozzoni all too well and presciently appreciated. With that, I think that's about all we have for today's program. So once again, I will thank you very much for listening, and I hope my digression on intervals was comprehensible and that you enjoyed that music. And we'll come back to listen to some more of our resounding echoes next week. Until then, goodbye.